News from the Bunker is brought to you by Tucker Survival.
You know, this flu, you know, affects the internal organs. And it's not like the 1918 flu. Let's talk about the 1918 flu in the lungs. So, as bad as a bout of real seasonal flu is, the H1 strain was far worse. It killed 2% or more of those stricken. In 1918, post-mortem examinations helped understand if it was a case of flu. The performance of those autopsies were harrowing. Influenza defiled the lungs with bloody, frothy fluid. Instead of floating, the lungs that were removed from the body during autopsy plummeted to the bottom of water buckets during autopsies. The bronchioles were fluid-filled, which explains the air hunger patients experience. I thought that was an interesting term, air hunger. They frequently died from suffocation within 24 to 48 hours of developing symptoms. Some died later from secondary infections. And the psychological effects are here in the literature. There are very few biographies of famous people who contracted influenza. An example includes F. Scott Fitzgerald. He contracted influenza and was disappointed that it caused him not to be able to go overseas. He did not write about it in his later works. Thomas Wolfe wrote a literary masterpiece about the death of his brother. More fabled is how influenza altered the decision-making abilities of President Woodrow Wilson's and his chief aide, Colonel Edward House, because they went over to do the peace talks, and I had known about this before, and they both got the flu, and it just whacked them, like, cognitively and mentally. And I don't think President Wilson ever recovered, from what I understand. So there was some residual effects from a neurological standpoint, cognitive decisions, and also internal organs. So for those critics, that's something to put in your pipe and smoke a little bit. There were a lot of orphans in 1918, too. In fact, there was a huge social movement to place all the children because so many children ended up without a parent. And the death issue, in 1918, the childhood mortality rate for children under 5 years old was 1 in 5.
Wow.
1 in 5 that got sick died. And also they cited that today death has been taken out of the household. In these days, in 1918, or today, very few people have seen someone die. But in 1918, it was probably 90% of people saw someone die, like in front of their face, because it was so there. I mean, if your mother is dead in bed for what was cited 6 to 8 days because there was nowhere to take her or take the father, that's pretty harsh.
Yeah.
You know? So we're not seeing that today.
No, and we're really not hearing about children dying from this. I mean, I've heard very few stories.
I think the first teenager died today or yesterday. It was actually in California. It was in Madera, which is Central Valley. And it was cited, from my understanding, that he had some comorbidities, so there was also some health problems there. That's another thing that we're not talking enough about. We're talking about, well, you know, people are obese. Let's talk about preventing this stuff in the future. Yeah. Because I believe the Chinese word for crisis is opportunity. So we have this crisis, but it's bringing to light, you know, as a health educator for decades, I can tell you, like, there's a lot of people that really need to address some issues. You know, before this pandemic comes through.
Well, that's what I would tell people. It's like you need to strengthen your immune system.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
That's really the best defense that you have.
You know, a little bit of physical fitness and, you know, eating some decent food. I'm not talking about, like, trying to be the next Jack LaLanne, but come on, man, at least go for a walk and don't go to McDonald's every day.
Yeah.
You know, and have food that doesn't have a whole list of ingredients that you can't pronounce. I mean, that it does factor in. And this constant use of social media and technology and never being able to turn off our brain is I don't think we understand how detrimental that can actually be. So if we look at, we're going to talk a little bit about cities. So in Los Angeles, because that's where I live, the death rate in LA was 494 to 100,000 people. And that actually was a little bit better than some cities. So this gives you a timeline, since we're so close to Los Angeles. September 26th, they recorded the first civilian case in 1918. In October 10th, the flu advisors met and drafted closures. The very next day, on October 11th, there was a state of emergency issued in LA, and they closed, they sent out the closing orders and they shut the schools down. On November 21st, they lifted the flu ban. On December 2nd, this closure ban lifted. On December 10th, the schools closed again because there was another little wave. And then January 9th, they started to reopen, and the last schools reopened on February 6th. So we've got a period from the end of September to basically the beginning of January, and then after that, it was a very slow taper off. So that's LA. That's how they did it. And if we go up to San Francisco, which was quite a bit different, they had some pretty sad statistics there. Remember, they had very restrictive mask policies. September 23rd, they recorded the first flu case in 1918. October 18th, they implemented bans and closures. So they waited quite a while to make a decision. But they did not close the churches, but they had recommendations for them to go outside. October 21st, 3 days later, they made strong mask recommendations, and there was a whole mask patriotism rhetoric campaign implemented. It was very patriotic to wear a mask, and very unpatriotic not to wear a mask in certain cities.
It's kind of flip-flop today.
Yes. Well, it is what it is. It's interesting. October 25th, mask mandated for all except while eating, and they were very restrictive. November 16th, the ban started to be lifted, but with some restrictions. On November 25th, the schools reopened. On November 21st, the masks were removed. On December 7th, the flu increases again. On January 10th, the mask order was reinstated. On February 1st, the mask order was lifted again. And so that's why when the first time they got to take the mask off, the people were just flooding the sewers with them. But San Francisco, in comparison, had a 673 to 100,000 people death rate. Wow. So that was one of the highest or the highest in the country. So that's just in one state. LA was 494 to 100,000 death rate. San Francisco was 673 to 100K.
Now, how did they enforce the mask? Were they writing fines?
Oh, well, yes, they were. In fact, some cities would actually put you in jail. I think the fine was $5. If I remember right, in some of the cities, which, you know, it doesn't back sound, then, but back then, $5, I mean, that was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And you were put in jail, too. So, yes, it did. Some of it was very, very highly enforced and very vigorously enforced. Detroit was the city that had the hunter who was worried about the mental part of people being in a panic state. And they got their first United States Navy cases September 20th. Their first flu death October 1st. The media began to report it on October 3rd. On October 5th, they started requesting that people start making restrictions. October 12th, they canceled non-essential surgeries. By mid-October, they had implemented the bans, banned dances, meetings, furlough. They cut the soldier furlough so they couldn't come into Detroit. And then they banned soldiers from coming into Detroit on October 17th. And then the governor of the state of Michigan issues closure orders except for schools on October 19th. And then on October 24th, they closed the schools. October 27th, the peak crest was announced. On November 6th, the ban was lifted. So their period in Detroit went from about October 5th to November 6th. So about a month.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of action in a month. From a public policy standpoint, we're doing this. Now we're not doing it. We're doing this. Now we're not doing it. And all they had was radio.
Yeah, you think about how they had to communicate all of this.
Yeah, they had radio and billboards. And they also,
newspaper,
well, they leveraged the theaters, but some of the theaters were closed.
Yeah.
So one of the arguments for keeping theaters open and movie houses was they could be used to do the propaganda and the public health education piece and how to deal with the flu and the hygiene part of it. So that was something in there.
Now, but, did the government help the businesses that closed down? Like we're seeing that today with all these loans and stuff, or they basically said, you guys have got to shut down?
That's a really good question.
Did they find other ways to kind of, you know,
I haven't seen
stay
that
in business?
Now, there are probably, I guess, maybe some help out there, but I haven't seen that highlighted in the reports now that you mentioned it. In Detroit, 28,986 people got infected. And this was the one city that did have a really significant spike, because their first spike came through and 18,066 people got infected. Their second spike infected 10,920. Now, that's really significant. And I haven't seen that in the other cities. So Detroit didn't do as well, and they didn't have a death rate reported. It's interesting because some of the reports report this stats in different ways. But I've went through Kansas City, and in fact, Washington, D.C., for those of you that doubt the government, they had the worst statistics in the country, like some of the worst, right? They had a death rate of 608 to 100,000 people, and they closed the schools on October 2nd, and they had 33,719 people infected, and they had 2,895 deaths. And I looked it up, and by May 2020 in Washington, D.C., that's this year, they had 3,657 infected. In 1918, they had 33,719 infected. So that's a little bit of a difference. I'm just saying, you might not like those statistics. I'm just reporting the information.
Well, this is what's interesting. You've spent your lockdown time studying some history.
Yes.
You know, if we all did that and started looking, we live in this age of information, you know, and spend our time digging instead of playing video games and,
well,
you know, mindless television.
Yeah, and I'll put my education hat on here for people. I mean, my real specialty now is studying classical leisure, like going back to ancient Greece, and that sounds completely ridiculous, but it's extremely important. It's been written throughout the history of mankind, that you can judge the longevity and the health of the nation by how they spend their leisure time. It's that important. And so when you look around the United States today, when we have now what's called forced leisure in history, that's when people really go crazy, because if they don't know how to spend their free time when they're not working, when they're not sleeping, when they're not eating, that's what leisure is, you're gonna go nuts. And so this is the importance of hobbies and skills, and especially doing things with your hands, whether you're hunting, fishing, working with wood, working with metal, auto shop, beading, macrame, knitting, sewing, cooking skills, playing a musical instrument. These are critically important, not just to make your brain fit, but to be mentally stable and to be a whole human being.
That's what I found with gardening.
Yeah, gardening.
So I'm out there, my hands are in the dirt, so you're like grounding with the dirt,
right.
Pulling weeds. I'm seeing my plants. I'm seeing like, oh, there's a snail.
You know,
you're down in it, and you're close to it.
The kids are missing so much today.
It's a real spiritual thing. When I grow plants from a seed, I wait, and I water, and I wait, and then finally it pops up. It's like, that's like a miracle. Tiny seed I could barely see, and now it's, you know, it's getting huge, and I'm getting, you know, tomatoes and stuff off of it.
Here's the thing, people. We've just went through the most significant period in your life to learn something new. We just went through. So I'm going to ask you right now, what did you learn? How did you improve in this pandemic lockdown? Because if you can't say something right now, you've blown your best opportunity ever to learn something. Because I had a lot of sitting around to do this spring and summer. And I have no shortage of books at my house because I'm a historian. So I just started reading all kinds of stuff, and I started learning how to play my drums better. And I did a bunch of wood projects, and I'm not as good as you, but you know, I do what I can. I was inspired by some of your survival stuff. So I got a new knife and some first aid kit, and I'm getting back into my EMT training a little bit. And so I've grown exponentially as a person and as a, just in terms of my knowledge base this year. It hasn't totally been negative. There's been a lot of bad stuff that's happened, but I've really grown. And I asked one of my students, because I'm teaching summer school this year, remote learning. It's all online. I never get to see my students. And she was talking about how bored she was, and her family's bored because they're just on their devices all the time, and they've watched all these movies. And I'm like, well, you know, classical Greece talked about leisure is supposed to elevate culture and educate the person. I go, this is your best opportunity to learn something. What have you learned this summer, besides summer school? Did you learn how to play an instrument or learn how to play it better? Did you learn how to cook? Did you learn how to sew? Did you learn how to do something out in the garden? And there was no response. Americans don't know how to use their free time for the most part. That's a general sweeping generalization, but we don't teach that in schools. I'm a credentialed teacher, I'm going to tell you. Most schools don't have shop classes. They don't teach skills for children to have really good hobbies. Most parents don't teach kids hobbies anymore. That's where you learn your hobbies. Most adults don't take up a new hobby. They do something they did when they were kids. Because we grew up working in the garage with their father, and we just kept doing stuff like dad did, you know, working on engines, working on wood projects, doing stuff with metal, working with tools. Our children today mostly are not learning those skills. Remember, this isn't just about getting work done. This is about being mentally stable as a nation, not just as an individual. That's how important this stuff is. So you bring up a great point. I could have been watching a bunch of stupid stuff on YouTube or TikTok, but instead I'm researching the flu.
And I told a group of young people, I said, this is a rare opportunity that you have right now.
Right.
But this was in the beginning of it.
Yeah.
To go into your psyche and to get to know yourself, and you may very well come out of this moving in a vastly different direction.
As you should.
So take advantage of this opportunity.
In a positive way.
You know, and I don't think any of them did, you know, because I don't see they've changed much.
Yeah.
And I did. I remember I got on it for 6 weeks. I'm doing 12-hour days. I'm building greenhouses and building all kinds of stuff and putting wood shops together.
Yeah.
I got to get prepared. I don't know what's coming, but I've been studying this when it started in China.
Yeah. So. And this isn't because a lot of your people are into survival stuff. This is a survival statement. When this thing went down in March, I predicted martial law to my friends, not in public. I might as well say it now. Martial law by the end of the summer. This is before the Black Lives Matter thing flared up and all that hadn't happened yet.
Yeah.
I predicted it right away. Why? Because I knew that Americans didn't know what to do with their free time, and I knew they were going to go crazy by sitting at home and not being able to do what's a lot of times just mindless amusement, mindless entertainment that doesn't educate and doesn't elevate culture. A lot of what we do as a country is just stupid. It just doesn't help us. So I knew that. I already knew it was going to go there. Yeah. And then we had the whole thing, you know, blow up with the social unrest. And so it doesn't surprise me to see what's happening because I know we don't have the right training to be mentally stable with excess amounts of free time.
Now, was there any of that back during the Spanish flu?
Was there
like some unrest? We're not doing this.
Well, there were protests and there was pushback, but nothing like I've seen today.
Yeah.
Yeah. And remember, we were also at war.
Yeah.
And the government was already hyper-controlling everything, or not everything, but quite a bit. In comparison to today, they had a heavy hand, according to the research that I've read. So we were already trained to do things a certain way and to groupthink out of survival. Because unless you're very highly skilled, you're not going to go out in the woods and survive by yourself indefinitely, right? So that's another thing that came out of this, and it's why the importance of being with real people in real time and not just always on a machine is critical, and not always having your face covered. And I'm looking forward to the days when we don't have those restrictions. I understand we might need to do it now. I'm not saying we shouldn't, but it does factor. But anyway, in those days, in that time, with the civics and education and the world war going on, the first real full modern world war, and then the flu on top of that, you know, we were pulling together. Let's just say that.
So in wrapping this up, what did you really take away from all your research, from what you knew when you started to research and then what you really found out about it in comparison to what we've got going on?
I don't think I knew a lot about it going in. I had watched some documentaries and things. I knew that it was bad and it killed a lot of people and it started in Kansas and not in Spain. But my big take-home points is that we were able 100 years ago to pull people together in a very short amount of time, make some monumental decisions, and implement those decisions with real action, not just talk, in 24 hours. We're talking about shutting a whole city down in 24 hours without a computer and without a smartphone. And it happened. It's not that, oh, well, they talked about it. No, they did it. There's city after city. Like, they got together, and once they made up their mind, it was on.
And across the country. So you know, you'd have communication across the country with new technology.
So that takes some nuevos. It takes some guts, and it was cited in a pandemic. You can't keep everyone happy. It's just the way it is. It reminds me of the old African proverb, a friend to everyone is a friend to no one. So at times, you just have to do it. And one of my military contact friends said, look, here's how it works in the military. There might be arguing about the decision to be made, but once the decision is made, everybody's in. Yeah. You can't second guess. Once the decision is made and we go into point, you have to go. And if you start fighting at that point, that's when a lot of people start dying. So my first take-home point is like, wow, these people were able to make decisions and make them quickly. The second big point was that the medical system was so much better integrated into the schools. I'm very concerned about schools today because we've got so many children so unhealthy before the flu hit, right? They're morbidly obese. They're completely out of shape. They're mentally like all over the place. And I'm going to tell you, the little boys are awful because of video games. They are just, they're completely fried. I mean, I got kids that have literally told me firsthand experience that they spent over 30 hours in a weekend playing, you know, a video game, Fortnite.
Wow.
And one kid said he played like 100 hours in 1 week. He missed Christmas dinner. He wouldn't even come down for Christmas dinner. Fourth grade.
I think he'd been reading, you know, stuff like this,
right,
in history books.
And so we went from physicians in schools and nurses and checking the students every single day, every single student in the school, really monitoring the health of the kids, to today where the kids are completely out of control. So as a teacher and educator, it's like, okay, here's our opportunity. This is really exposed. You want to talk about racism and equality? And the people of lower socioeconomic levels are being affected at a much higher rate and infected at a higher rate and dying at a higher rate. Let's help the tribe here. Let's make the school a healthier place. And so a big take-home point, guys, we need to ramp up the school health here, you know, because they did it better than we did in a lot of cities, not everywhere. Yeah. So they did it quickly. They used the schools, and they were medically supervised very, very well. The flu moved through very quickly. It was 2 to 6 weeks. And that part I didn't get. I had no idea it moved that fast, and people were back to work and opening up. And even at the long term was like 4 or 5 months for some places, including a longer taper off period. But it's like, hey, man, 4 or 5 months at this point... is looking like the drag strip, you know?
There were, early on in this, epidemiologists that had been doing this for 30-some-odd years said just that. They said, you know, we've handled this the wrong way.
Yep.
We should have let it go through. It would have gone through in X amount of days, and we'd be getting over this thing by now. They said, all we're doing is extending. The same number of people are going to get sick and die. We're just extending it out.
Yeah, New York, you know, there was a lot of... talk about hygiene and ventilation, because remember the tuberculosis thing was going on about the same time period too. So New York actually did not shut the schools down, and they kept things open a lot better. And New York had the best statistics on the Eastern Seaboard, even though they didn't shut down much. And so that was another thing that they were arguing about a little bit, the cities, because they were saying like there are some places that didn't do all the restrictions and they did better than some places that did do the restrictions. So, and to be honest with you, there's a lot of unanswered questions about the 1918 flu today. They still don't have all the answers. They still can't figure out why it was so much worse.
Well, and you're dealing with a virus, so there's a lot of variables.
Yeah.
From weather to what people are eating,
diet,
a lot of different variables that we're not really looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at some like city like San Francisco that's got sea air, well, maybe that affects it somehow.
Yeah, that a little bit of that was in the reports too.
You know, altitude, maybe mountain communities, higher altitude might have a different effect on the body and how the virus transmits.
Which has thrown us, because we've had some pretty good rates in the summer, and we thought, well, the summer is going to be like it's going to burn out and it's going to be the winter, but the thing actually hit in spring and summer.
Yeah.
And so, and it was cited in the reports that there is no like one time when only the flu comes through that time. It does vary. And it is, and they're all different to some degree. I will admit that. But from what I've seen, the 1918 flu was radically worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a different breed of flu, period, between the flus preceding it and following it. And so there's a lot to learn. That database is incredible. And a lot of people spent a lot of time putting that together. And having done some website work for 20 years, I'm just looking at that, like all those references linked to all those summary reports. Like, it's just a massive monster of data. It's the largest database in the world.
Now, is there a link that I could put in the description for that?
Yeah, so, I'll give you the link for this workshop, which I think was an extremely valuable reference. But then I'm also going to give you the link to where you can get a city report for, it's about probably 35 different major cities across the United States. And if you want to look at Buffalo, New York, if that's one, you just go there, and it's, the reports range from about 3 to 8 pages.
Yeah.
And they're written in a way that you can understand them, and they're not overly technical. And I just think it's just fascinating reading. I encourage people to look at it, and also, you know, study places on the coast and the Midwest and cooler climates and drier climates, and just take a little bit of an overview and enjoy your reading and spend your free time learning something.
Yeah, that way if somebody says, it's the same thing, it's like, well, actually, that's what I thought, and I kind of found some different answers.
It's given me some peace of mind, because when people start spouting off all this bull crap, it's like, well, actually, that's not what happened. It's like, well, you know, you don't know. It's like, well, actually, you know, I'm citing the biggest database in the world with decades of research that went into this, so... I guess you can say that it's not accurate, but if that's not accurate, we're in big trouble, because at some point you got to believe somebody, right?
Yeah. Well, Ron, I want to thank you for coming on down to the bunker.
Thanks, man. I enjoyed the bunker, man.
Yes. I have to give you a grand tour. So my name is Mark, and I want to thank you for tuning in to News from the Bunker Special Report. And you can also catch this on the podcast version. And you can go to tuckersurvival.com, where you can check out our blogs, get links to different things we got going on, like I say, the podcasting and things like that. And we'll be doing some stuff on gardening and raising chickens and all kinds of cool stuff. So again, I want to thank you for tuning in to News from the Bunker Special Report with Ron Jones. You have a good time out there and stay safe.
News from the Bunker is brought to you by Tucker Survival and is produced by MBJ Media Services.